often directly elected mayors add most value to their cities and communities, whether at city, region or local authority level.
If you are part of a great city region, how do you make the most of your relationship with your core city and regional centre?
And in times of rapid and wide-ranging transformation, how can you increase local economic growth and social inclusion concurrently?
I'm Mike Spicer, and welcome to LED Confidential, the podcast that tries to lift the lid on those intractable and enduring challenges facing those of us working in and on local economic development and placemaking today.
And I'm David Marlowe. Join us for another really special episode of LED Confidential. So, Mike, I mean, I think it was way back in the second ever episode of LED Confidential when we were joined by Tom Stannard, Chief Exec of Salford City Council. And we focused mainly on what makes a great economic development organisation, perhaps reflecting Tom's wider roles in the LED and Placemaking Institute for Economic Development, where he is now chair.
Well, that was obviously the pivotal moment in Tom's career, wasn't it? Coming on to our podcast. That's what LED Confidential can do for you.
I have to say that I always felt it would be good at some stage to return to the specific Salford story, which, as our opening provocation suggests, has so many fascinating, really important layers. And before I bring in our guest, I mean, do you want to tell us just a little bit about what you know about Salford?
Well, I guess the word that always springs to mind when I think of Salford is transformation, really. And it's probably worth saying that millions of Brits see Salford every single day when they tune in to the primetime breakfast and evening shows. And they see Salford as that modernist backdrop to the BBC sofa. But of course, it didn't always look like that. Many of our listeners, being the experts in economic development that they are, will probably know Salford as having a really rich history. One that takes in the Industrial Revolution, the role it played there with cotton spinning, as a major player in pushing forward social progress in the 1800s and early 1900s, and of course the pivotal role it played in UK goods trade as an inland port with the construction of the Manchester Ship Canal. But like many other places that emerged as powerhouses in the industrial period, deindustrialization, the closure of the docks in the early 1980s, put it in a position where it needed a new purpose. And it's the fruits of that regeneration that millions of our countrymen and women see every day on the TV. Of course, you've got Salford Quays and a thriving cultural hub, the Lowry, Media City UK and its dedicated media quarter, many other modern developments that you see there. But I guess, you know, it throws up some really interesting questions that I hope we can get into today. Questions about how do you do economic development in a way that involves local communities? How do you live a really large scale and really, you know, significant change in an area? And what role do the arts and culture sector play in sustainable economic growth? So lots and lots of stuff there, David.
Yeah, and that's in addition to the provocations. I mean, we've really got a lot of ground to cover. I mean, so without further ado, I'm absolutely thrilled to be able to introduce Mayor Paul Dennett, the directly elected mayor of Salford City Council. Paul was first elected as directly elected mayor of Salford in 2016, re-elected in 2021. He has also been, or is also, Deputy Mayor of Greater Manchester Combined Authority, working closely with Mayor Andy Burnham and Greater Manchester colleagues. And I think I'm right in saying he majors in GMCA on a health, lives and homelessness portfolio. I mean, Paul, Mike and I are absolutely delighted you've managed to take some time out of what must be an exhausting schedule to join us on LED Confidential. A warm welcome. I mean, you've heard some of our scene-setting comments. I mean, where would you like to take the conversation in the next 40 minutes or so?
Well, I guess, where do we begin, really? Because I think you've already highlighted that Salford's journey has been, as you rightly say, transformational. And I think transformation is the word that epitomises the journey we've been on. And this journey has a long lead-in time. And I know we often start with the BBC, but we mustn't forget the millennial project that was the Lowry Theatre and Art Gallery. which was a real institutional kind of catalyst, I think, for what we saw come after in terms of when the BBC opened its doors in 2011. But I think for me, I think it's important to contextualise all of this because, you know, certainly my time now as the elected mayor coming up for 8 years has been happening in a period of austerity, which I certainly know has disproportionately impacted local government and inevitably hampered our agency to deliver even more amazing things than we've delivered to date when you look at Salford's journey. But also we need to contextualise that in terms of the acknowledgement of the global pandemic and more recently the cost of living crisis that we're all grappling with. And on Monday of this week, I mean, it's quite interesting, the consultation on the Provisional Local Government Finance Settlement closed. And needless to say, yesterday at our full council meeting, I had an awful lot to say about all of that, really. And for us, I think in Salford, we've always known, and I'm talking about the politics of the city here, we're a Labour-run local authority. I'm a Labour Party elected mayor here in the city of Salford, coming towards the end of my second term, and I've been selected, if you like, by the Labour Party to do another third term. But we've always known that the best antidote to tackling poverty and inequality in the city of Salford is to grow our economy. Many people, as you've rightly highlighted in your opening address there, are nostalgic, really, about the industrial past of the city. We were the heart of the Industrial Revolution. The Bridgewater Canal was the precursor to the Manchester Ship Canal, which then gave rise to all of those cotton mills and dye works and factories along many of our historic waterways that we continue to celebrate even to this day. But also the importance of the inland docks in terms of our relationship with the Port of Liverpool and the importance of that port in what was a global economy at the time. You know, we were exporting things around the world and it was a hive of activity, which obviously led to many of the things we hold dear today. And, you know, I speak to things like Peel Park, you know, the first public park in the city of Salford at a time when parks and green spaces were seen as the preserve of, you know, landed gentry, royalty, or people who could afford to have such spaces. And, you know, the brave politicians back in the day spoke to the importance of things being publicly accessible. You know, Salford is credited as having the first public lending library in the country. We're also credited with the innovations around gas street lighting, you know, on our streets. You know, it's all about the public good. And, you know, when you think about the city of Salford's first MP, Joseph Brotherton, delivering things like Wheath Cemetery, he was incidentally the first MP to be buried in that cemetery and the first person to be buried in that cemetery. And I think there was a procession of 2.5 miles. So you really appreciate how, you know, our politicians, historically speaking, were really well regarded, I think, by members of the public and their communities. But yeah, we've been on a journey. And I think we are nostalgic about the past, our industrial past, but we're also nostalgic, and rightly so, about our past because we see it as a radical past. We see it as a past that speaks to the public good, the importance of community and society, and the importance of politicians taking the issues and concerns that people have of the day seriously and delivering on them. So yeah, we're a city that gets things done as well, I guess you would say, and certainly a city that values innovation and creativity.
Just speak a little bit about the directly elected mayor model. I mean, it is something that I've also had some intimate experience with because I helped with introducing the directly elected mayor into Doncaster. I think it was in 2001. I mean, you actually have sort of two mayoral models concurrently in Greater Manchester and Salford. I mean, how does that actually help the political leadership, the radical political leadership you've spoken about, and what is needed to make the most of a mayoral model?
So it's a really good question, this. And, you know, you could argue I've gone native because I am a directly elected mayor in terms of answering this. But I will try and be really objective in terms of responding to that provocation. I am actually someone who fundamentally believes in this model. However, there are inevitably risks with this. And like any model of governance, it certainly isn't perfect. And obviously, the clear risk is making sure you get the right person for the job. Because if you get the wrong person, you know, 4 years of having a directly elected mayor could be disastrous for a local authority, for a city like Salford. So I think we need to be really honest about that. However, there are clear safeguards in place. So, for example, in terms of the Labour Party selecting their candidate, literally every single member has a vote on who the directly elected mayor would be. And obviously, under the previous model, which was the strong leader and cabinet model, ultimately the leader was decided through horse trading within the Labour group. And, you know, democratically looking at those two models just through that lens alone, I think really supports directly elected mayors as the model for local government moving forward. One, because it's more democratic, and also one would hope that by increasing significantly, ultimately, the sample size of people who can influence who becomes their mayoral candidate, you end up getting, hopefully, a better candidate and the right person for the job, rather than it all being subjected to horse trading and potential factionalism, if you like, within Labour groups or political party groups running local authorities up and down the country. So on that basis alone, I think there's real merit in the model. And interestingly, in Salford's case, the mayoral model was called by a referendum, and that referendum was called by the people of Salford. Obviously, the required numbers of signatures were submitted. The council considered those and then held the referendum, and the people voted. At the time, during that referendum, the Labour Party took a position to campaign against a directly elected mayor model. And, you know, it's primarily for all the reasons I talked about earlier, potentially the threat of not getting the right person, the autocracy of the role in terms of the power that is afforded to a directly elected mayor constitutionally in terms of the decision making of local government. But also, I think, you know, the Labour Party, and rightly so, fundamentally believes in collectivism and everybody being involved in the decision making of the local authority. And that includes, you know, all the developments that have happened over a number of years, which predate my own term of office, around, you know, participative democracy. So things like community committees, devolved budgets, all of that stuff that happened many, many years ago, which we've tried to continue, but obviously struggled to because of the impacts of austerity and local government cuts. But I think in terms of beyond that, you know, you do have a lot of flexibility in terms of how you structure the governance of the local authority. So I've democratized the directly elected mayor model because I have a mayoral team, I have cabinet leads, they're all politicians, Labour Party politicians, because Labour control the executive of the city council. They have executive support members, they take decisions within their areas of activity, and we have a cabinet which also collectively takes decisions as well, if it's deemed appropriate that that's the level on which they take. However, the benefits for me of having a directly elected mayor, beyond what I've already talked about, are also about the soft power of the office. So using the soft power of the office, not only in terms of the press, the media and public relations terms, but also in terms of galvanizing the city, bringing people together, trying to sort out issues and concerns as and when they arise. And also the other benefit for me is around the speed at which you can move in cases where you're confronted with an emergency or the need to take an urgent decision. I think that has significant value under a direct elected mayor model, whereas a committee system or a strong leader and cabinet model, I don't think you have the speed at which you can take decisions in the same way afforded to you. But for me, the role of a directly elected mayor in convening the place, convening the city, championing the place and the people of the place and the communities of a place, I don't think we can put enough emphasis on the absolute importance of that. Because, you know, power for me is something you acquire in many respects to give away. It's not something you acquire for yourself. And, you know, I might be a peculiar politician in that respect, but nevertheless, for me, the way you achieve things is by encouraging and motivating people to get behind a vision, a collective vision for the plays, and then obviously working collectively to deliver on that. Because collaboration and partnership is where it's at for me, whether that's with our vibrant community, voluntary, social, enterprise sector and faith sector, whether that's with the private sector, the small, medium enterprises within the city of Salford, whether that's with big institutions like, you know, the hospital or the university or, you know, Media City and what we're trying to achieve there. All of it is about people. All of it is about place. All of it is about partnership and collective working. And all of it is about being bought into a vision, a meta-narrative, if you like, for the city of Salford and delivering on that vision collectively. And, you know, I, it would be remiss of me not to be reminded of the motto of the city council, Salus Populi Suprema Lex, the welfare of the people is the highest law. Everything for me in this job, certainly over the last nearly 8 years, has all been about people. And that's how you get things done. And that's how you deliver for a place.
Is the model different at metropolitan level than it is at an individual local authority level? Or are they basically similar models with similar dynamics?
So clearly, in terms of statutory responsibilities, they differ. There's no doubt about that. So, you know, in my case here in Greater Manchester, Mayor Andy Burnham is not running or being responsible for things like children's services, adult services, public health. And obviously with the advent of things like integrated care systems, even that world now sits somewhat out with the combined authority and the directly elected mayor. Obviously, Mayor Andy Burnham is responsible for police and crime. He's the directly elected mayor as well as the police and crime commissioner. He's also responsible for fire. And, you know, there is definitely a division of labor that's happening here. And I think Greater Manchester, to be honest with you, is very much ahead of the game really here when it comes to devolution, city regional governance, metro mayors, because before all of that architecture in legal and governance terms came about, and let's not forget, you know, that was contingent on agreeing with government, central government, devolution. So we would have to have a directly elected mayor here in Greater Manchester if we were to receive devolution, i.e. more control over resources locally rather than Westminster and Whitehall determining what happens for the people of Greater Manchester. But there is a division of labour there. But for me, I think in Greater Manchester, even prior to all of this stuff, there's been a long-standing history of collaboration, of partnership. And, you know, this goes back to the days when we used to have a Greater Manchester Council. And, you know, all of the collaboration we had when we had regional development agencies in place. I think we know fundamentally in Greater Manchester that to get the best out of national government and to get the best out of a global economy, partnership and collaboration across the 10 local authorities is absolutely where it's at. And having stability there politically is a huge advantage, I think, within the United Kingdom currently, but also a huge advantage within a global economy, because we have clarity over what we want to achieve, where we want to achieve it, when we want to achieve it. And we have strategies and policies that have been collectively agreed within the combined authority across the 10 local authorities. And then how that interfaces with local government is interesting. And I've always been very clear that when we're doing things at a city regional level, it needs to add value and amplify issues that we're facing within the districts. But, you know, in statute and in policy terms, there is a clear division of labour going on between what the city region is responsible for, how it's adding value, and ultimately what the districts are responsible for, and how, you know, those roles are different, but also have a relationship with each other and complement each other.
We've touched a few times in this podcast so far on the ways in which Salford and perhaps Greater Manchester more generally has been radical in certain ways. So we've talked about its sort of radical past around improvements in the public realm, economically, going back to the Industrial Revolution, socially, and some of the kind of social policy innovations that have started in that part of the world. If we're going to be radical going into the future, as you say, what does radical look like thinking into the future? And as a mayor, as a directly elected mayor, what do directly elected mayors in the future, what will they need to do differently in order to achieve that? How much of that is about sort of policy that has to be negotiated with the centre, and how much of it is about the agency of individuals at the local level?
Yeah, I mean, these are fascinating questions, and these are things certainly I've been thinking about. When we use the word radical, I find it quite interesting because, you know, dare I say it, if we look at what we think is radical today and contrast that with the radicalism of the past, we might find that it isn't necessarily radical what we're arguing for today when compared and contrasted with history. But for me, radicalism is informed by, certainly in my case, my socialism, my values, my beliefs, and my genuine desire to deliver what I first campaigned on when I became mayor, which is a better and fairer Salford. So for me, that is fundamentally what radicalism is all about. And it's also about the motto of the city council, which I mentioned before, that the welfare of the people is the highest law. You know, I'm reminded every single day that, you know, public office, having agency, whether that's institutional agency through the council or agency through people or even through the office of the directly elected mayor here in Salford, is all about trying to deliver for the people of Salford. And, you know, if we deem that as radical, then so be it. And how are we doing that? Well, we're doing that in lots of different ways. And I think an area I would probably like to focus on, which does speak to the city region as well, is housing and homelessness. I think Mayor Burnham has been a game changer within the United Kingdom in terms of his policy priority being tackling homelessness and rough sleeping and ultimately the housing crisis, because, you know, I see homelessness and rough sleeping as a symptom of the housing crisis. So there's a direct connection here. But the work we've done in Greater Manchester has really led the way, I think, in this country to, one, shed a light on the crisis that is the UK housing market and how broken all of that is. But two, it's also placed people at the heart of what we're all about and imbuing policy, strategy and decision making with lived experience, with co-production, getting people who experience the consequences of our system to actually shape policy, strategy and decision making, I think is fairly radical. It's holding politicians and civil servants and officers to account in a very different way. It's not just through the electoral process. It's not just through the complaint system. It's by actually genuinely empowering people to shape what we do and how we do it here in the city region. And for me, I think that is really something we should be cheerleading and shouting about. And whether that's through Mayor Burnham's bed every night, whether that's through some of the housing first stuff, you know, learning from Scandinavia, whether that's the trauma-informed approach we're taking to how we support people who find themselves in the awful situation of being homeless or even worse, being rough sleepers in the city region. I just think it's really great. And, you know, it's very unfortunate that Westminster and Whitehall haven't really got on board with this agenda. I mean, they can probably point to small pots of money in the grand scheme of things where they've created this initiative or that initiative. But when I say they've not got on board, this has happened at a time when councils have still continued to make cuts. You know, in Salford's case, when we set the budget in March, we will have taken £245 million out of the revenue budget. That's cuts to the revenue support grant, which we know has not played out evenly across the country. Local government financing has become highly politicised, certainly since 2010-11. But it's also unfunded budget pressures. So pay awards every year. We go through the regional pay consultations for local government workers. The LGA has a role in all of that. But actually, that is a budget pressure year on year for councils to meet and to address. And we get no money from the centre to deal with any of that. So all of that makes all of this stuff around housing and homelessness really challenging. In addition to the whole supply issue, you know, dominant housing policy in this country has been that the market will deliver the homes we need. Well, we know that's fundamentally not worked. Time and time again, when development is brought forward through planning committees, do we see developers turning around to us to say schemes are not viable, we need subsidy from government, we can't deliver affordable housing. You know, the list goes on in terms of what they can't deliver. And all the time, you know, from a land transaction point of view, you know, the landowners often walk away not having to think about any of these sorts of issues and making an absolute fortune off the back of planning permission being granted and development being brought forward. So, you know, the National Planning Policy Framework's inability to capture land value and build that into how we deliver infrastructure and affordable housing obviously sits at the heart of some of these problems. And I know government have reformed some of that recently, but they certainly haven't spoken to the issue of land value capture in the revised National Planning Policy Framework. So, I mean, we could talk a lot about housing and homelessness and some of those structural issues that are exacerbating and causing it. I mean, a real issue for us right now is what the Home Office are doing. So the Home Office, as we know, the government has committed to accelerated asylum, getting through the backlog by the end of the year. Now that, in principle, sounds great. In practice, what that means is as soon as someone receives either a positive or negative decision, they're evicted from their current home and forced to turn up to local councils like my own. And under the Homelessness Reduction Act, we owe them a duty to housing. They move into temporary housing. But we do not owe everybody a duty, as you know. In England, that is the case. In Scotland, obviously, it's very different. So right now, we've had to set up an emergency welfare hub to basically house people. So people are communal living on airbeds, basically, in the city of Salford. That is scandalous for one of the wealthiest economies, countries in the world. So this is what I mean. I mean, things are complex, absolutely. But Westminster and Whitehall, for me, could work so much more with city, regional government, local government, to have a proper strategic relationship that places the welfare of the people at the heart of everything we do.
I certainly take your point about the capturing of land value. And one of the things that always worries me, if you like, about the way that government from the centre actually does set the regime for national planning is that, you know, why don't they actually allow different, particularly mayoralties at the metro level, to set their own policies? You know, why does government actually approves strategic planning guidance and frameworks at a Greater Manchester level? Why does it set the regime for land capture? And why can't there be a much better sort of multi-level of governance collaboration to actually come up with a system that works best for Greater Manchester and Salford? And I suppose because Greater Manchester has been so much at the forefront of these agendas for such a long time, I suppose the question to ask is, you know, if, for example, land capture systems and regimes were to be given a much greater level of devolution, does Greater Manchester have a solution that would actually work?
I think this is a really, really important issue. And does Greater Manchester have a solution that would work? Absolutely. So outside of London, as far as I'm aware, we're the only city region which is at a point virtually of implementing a spatial plan for the entire city region. And that spatial plan speaks to meeting local housing need, i.e. the government's housing targets. It speaks to having a land supply to meet that need. It speaks to the infrastructure required to deliver on our economic growth aspirations. It speaks to the industries and the sectors we think we've got competitive advantages in within a national economic context. It speaks to the importance of government working with us here to look at how, you know, the Treasury's Green Book appraisal really needs to be revised in the interests of genuinely rebalancing the economy within the United Kingdom. And, you know, that isn't a kind of criticism of London, because we also need the City of London to equally be successful in all of this. But what it is it's a position for me which genuinely speaks to the importance of industrial and sectoral planning. And I don't think we've done that very well in this country, if I'm really honest with you. I think the fact that the government kicked the industrial strategy into the long grass was not terribly helpful. And, you know, forcing local authorities up and down the country to compete in this space is absolutely not in the interests of UK PLC. It might be in the interests of bureaucracy and growing the state, but it certainly isn't in the interests of running an efficient and an effective state. And actually, I think there's a bigger prize to be won here by thinking about the relationship between, you know, the market, the private sector, and the state ultimately, and what role local government, city, regional government plays in all of that. And importantly as well for us in Salford, certainly, the role of the voluntary community, faith, and social enterprise sector. It's a really vibrant part of our city. And during COVID, and certainly during the last 13 years of austerity, that sector has been exceptionally supportive to local government. And I do worry where we'd be without it, if I'm honest with you, in terms of the volunteers, the charities, the third sector organisations, the faith-based organisations, who've really stepped up to the plate, really, in our city to support residents and communities in what have been really challenging times, and even to this day, in the middle of the cost of living crisis. And we know that sector's struggling, and a lot of those relationships with local government aren't necessarily formal ones either. So I do think thinking about them in the mix in all of this is equally important. But I think you're right. I just think there's a bigger prize to be won. I mean, the Labour Party, if they form the next government, are talking about land value capture. They're talking about enhancing CPO powers for local authorities. For me, it's not just a legislative or a powers issue. It's a resourcing issue, because I know, certainly from my local authority's point of view, regulatory services have been decimated over the last 13 years. They've been hugely diminished. So making sure local government financing is considered in the mix here to ensure we've got enough resources to do all of this, as well as things like, you know, properly regulating the private rented sector, where we've got huge issues with housing standards, is really, really important. But yeah, I think this can be done. I don't think this requires a radical solution necessarily. What it does require is for Westminster and Whitehall to let go and to ensure that city regions and local authorities are properly resourced. That's where we need to go with this. I think in Greater Manchester's terms, we've already got the strategy. It's already been through inspection. We're now at a point where we're wanting to implement that. And obviously, the next challenge then becomes, how do we actually deliver on the vision and the strategy that we've all collectively worked over many years, by the way, and spent significant amounts of public resources on all of this work to deliver for the people of Greater Manchester.
Paul, so just thinking about the kind of the wider region that you sit in. So we talked a bit about the kind of the relationship between Salford and Greater Manchester, but the wider northwest of England, it has some big urban areas. It has, you know, Liverpool, for example, is pretty close by. What's been your experience of working collaboratively with other cities, other major places, kind of outside of Greater Manchester, but within your broader region? And how do you make that really work for all of you? You know, how do you get the balance right between being kind of friendly and competitive, competitors in prestige as well as economically, but also working collaboratively in a way that kind of leverages, you know, the kind of common capabilities and networks between you?
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting question. And I say that also knowing that Salford currently holds the Secretariat for Key Cities. So an interest group, a lobbyist organisation, my deputy mayor, Councillor John Merry, is the chair of Key Cities. And obviously that is cities all across the country, not just here in the north or the northwest, working in the interests of their places. I think my general take on all of this is, I think there's a long way to go to properly get us into a proper strategic space around that entire agenda, around how do cities and towns and places collaborate, one, in the interests of their own local authorities and their people, but also in the interests of UK PLC. I don't think we're quite there. I think a lot of the discourse and the debate and discussions to date have been about how we connect up these places in kind of infrastructure terms, and primarily public transport. And certainly a lot of the conversations here in Greater Manchester have been around, you know, the electrification of our railway and how we connect to Liverpool, how we connect to Leeds. And then obviously you'll be familiar with the really unfortunate decision we had around HS2 and it not moving beyond the West Midlands. But I actually think there's a much bigger prize to be won in that space around talking about industrial, sectoral, economic collaboration, and how that's aligned to, you know, HE institutions who are very involved and engaged in the space of R&D and innovation. Because, you know, we've got to be really honest with ourselves at the moment. The global economy is in transition. The jobs of the future actually aren't necessarily known to us. We know digital and tech has sped things up exponentially and is having huge implications across all sectors of our economy. And all of that, for me, points to the need for much more collaboration and partnership between local authorities, between key cities, core cities, between city regional government. Because if we're serious about the welfare of the people and the people we all seek to serve and represent, then we've got to get serious about UK PLC. And that, for me, I think points to some more really industrial planning and economic planning that, you know, happens potentially at a city regional or multi-city regional level, or even at the heart of Westminster and Whitehall in the mix on some of this as well. And whatever it is in terms of the way forward, we've got to work much more collaboratively to realise what I often talk about, which is acknowledging that we are greater than the sum of our parts, if we're serious about wanting to realise that, that is.
Are we going to have to draw to a close shortly, Paul? I mean, this has been absolutely fascinating. I'd like to close my bit, at least, with going back to the third provocation. I mean, you've rightly highlighted the transformation that has happened in Salford. And I suppose my question, and I'm doing a lot of work on this at the moment, is the question around inclusive innovation. You know, has the transformation of Salford actually increased inequalities? Has it reduced them? And in a sense, what powers and resources do you and Greater Manchester need to ensure that growth does go alongside social mobility, community cohesion, and people feeling that the transformation, I mean, you started off with the nostalgia for the Industrial Revolution. How do we get to a stage where people own radical growth-oriented change and actually participate in and benefit from it?
I have a lot to say on this. So when I got on the council, which is nearly 12 years ago, I was in the previous mayor's cabinet leading on workforce inequality, tackling inequality more to the point, and also industrial relations. For me, there was an inherent need at that point in time, and it was kind of New Labour that forced me to join the Labour Party. And, you know, I just want to talk a little bit about this. It was this notion of new public management, which kind of was the real catalyst for me to get political. So I saw a government at that time, you know, massively engaging with things like private finance initiatives, public-private partnerships, all of the off-balance sheet spending we were doing as a country to make the debt and the deficit look much better than it really was to the European Union. I had real concerns about all of that, because what we were doing, in a sense, was committing future generations to that public spending. And some of the contracts that were very much in that space were hugely problematic from a value for money point of view. So that's what politicized me. And that's also what drew me into the party. And within all of that, I genuinely felt there was a need for recalibrating how we do things within the United Kingdom. For me, the pendulum has swung far too far towards this whole notion of neoliberalism, free market economics. You know, you even had, I think, the government at the time talking about private sector efficiency, you know, almost a dig at bureaucracies as being hugely inefficient. Well, I've always believed in the public sector ethos. And for me, local government are the unsung heroes of the state and often the fourth emergency service. So I'm a great advocate of local government. But for Salford specifically, I felt economically we needed to recalibrate things. So I was determined to deliver an inclusive economic growth agenda where no one is left behind in the city of Salford, because despite our growth, we'd actually worsened in terms of the government's index of multiple deprivation. We're now the 18th poorest local authority in the country. And, you know, this is also at a time when Salford is receiving accolades, you know, Centre for Thriving Places, being seen as a green city. And more recently, even, you know, right-wing broadsheets, The Telegraph, actually rating us in the top 10 as best value cities for quality of life in 2024. So, you know, it's not that we're not being recognised, but for me, what we need to do is recalibrate this. So how do we leverage growth, economic development, to genuinely tackle issues of poverty and inequality? And that's what I've been trying to do over the last 8 years. And how do we do that in a way where public ownership is taken seriously? You know, I have had concerns with the gentrification model. Yes, we need investment. Yes, we need growth. But that shouldn't mean we have to almost just facilitate the market and have no place within it. So for me, it's been about rebuilding council housing. It's been about using our land holdings to create jobs and opportunities for people in the city. Startup businesses, artists, creatives and makers. Some of the stuff we're doing at Islington Mill is just absolutely fantastic. And there's more to be done in that space to support artists, creatives and makers. But it's also about being serious about tackling poverty. So we have an anti-poverty strategy in the city of Salford. We have an equalities and inclusion strategy. And that, with the inclusive and green economy strategy, is kind of what I would refer to as the Salford way, or sensible socialism, I like to call it. And it does speak to what I was talking about before, about being greater than the sum of our parts, because the delivery of that can not solely be delivered through the agency of local government. And that isn't to continue with that new public management discourse of hollowing out the state, turning councils into commissioning and contracting entities. That speaks to the importance of democratizing the public realm, of ownership, of us having a stake in how our economy moves forward. It also speaks to, you know, some of the radicalism of the past here in Greater Manchester, campaigning for the real living wage. We were the first council to become an accredited real living wage council here in Greater Manchester. But also now we know we've got over 100 organisations in the city, and over 3,000 people have seen their pay boosted as a consequence of all of the campaigning we do within that space. We also work with anchor institutions, so people like the university and the hospital, speaking to that partnership point, to ensure that we commission and contract with local suppliers, keeping the Salford pound in the city of Salford, getting employers in the city to sign the City Mayor's Employment Standards Charter. I think we have around 135 organisations signed up to that, which is about pay and conditions. It's about skills and career development opportunities. We've also put $1.5 million recently into skills and work. We employ a director now for skills and work in the City Council. Non-statutory activity sits within the Department for Work and Pensions, but really important for us if we're to tackle poverty and inequality. And also, I think we're the first council in England to ask our major developers to take seriously the issue of social value, social impact, requiring of them a social value strategy when development is brought forward. So we're doing a lot. But as I said earlier, you know, 13 years of austerity, the COVID pandemic, the cost of living crisis, interest rates and inflation at the moment is hampering the agency of local government. And that environment, that context does need to be taken seriously when we look at the issue of inclusive growth. Because it's back to what I said before. If central government, Westminster and Whitehall, the city region and city councils like Salford all worked in the interest of our people and our economy and society, I genuinely do believe there is a bigger prize to be won in all of this.
Fabulous. I'm so glad that we came back to Salford after Tom in whenever it was a couple of years ago. Mike, do you have any final words before we wrap it up?
Just really thanks, Paul, for coming on the show. It's great to be able to discuss these issues in depth. And you know, there are a lot of people in our listenership who will be really keen to learn about Salford. You know, it has a very prominent place within the UK's economic development family of professionals. So there's going to be a lot of people interested in what you have to say about the journey of your city and the wider city region as well, I think. But yeah, thanks for coming on the show, David. I think that's us wrapped up for this episode. To our listeners, you can get loads of great material from our website, listen to other episodes as well on www.ledconfidential.co.uk. Bonus material, drop us a line on what you think, suggestions for future episodes, guests always gratefully received, and we will be with you on the next one. Thank you very much.